touch the microphone, apparently. Well, good morning. It is really, really good to see so many familiar faces and to see so many people that I know. And it's good to be here. It's a mixture of very, very good and very, very strange, I have to say. But mostly good. For many of you, mine is a familiar face, but I don't want to assume that it is for everyone. And so I thought before I began, I should have at least a bit of an introduction or an update on where our family has been for the last 6 years. Some of you haven't seen us for almost 6 years. Many of you have seen us in between that time. But I thought I would begin this morning. Well, I should actually, first of all, begin by thanking you for allowing me to come and speak to you this morning and for inviting me. It really is a real privilege to be here and to see the life and the smiling faces and the evidence of God's work among you. And so thank you for inviting our family to be here today. So for those of you who don't know, my name is Ryan Duick. And for the first 30 years of my life, this church was my home. This is where I first went to Sunday school. This is where I first attended youth group. This is where I first was involved in a worship team. This is where I was given my first opportunities to preach and to teach Sunday school classes. So there's a lot of firsts for me in this place. This is the place where I was first encouraged to pursue higher education. I think of people like Randy and Darlene Clausen. Many of you, those names will be familiar. Some, it will not. I apologize for that. But this is a place of many firsts for me. This is the church in which my faith was born, and where it was watered, and where it was nourished, and where it grew. And so I owe a huge debt of gratitude to this church and to these people, to you people, for investing in me in countless ways over the course of the first 3 decades of my life. Probably in ways that I'm not even aware of. But so that's a bit of a very brief introduction about who I am and my connection to this place. I've been keeping track of you from afar. I've been gone 6 years, but my ears are always open to what's going on at Coaldale MB, because this is my home, and this is, in many ways, I think of this as my home still. And so I've been very interested to hear about this place, even when I was on BC, and since I've been back here in Alberta. So maybe you're wondering what we've been up to for the last 6 years, since you've last seen us. Well, by us, I should say, my wife Naomi is right there. She's waving. For those who don't know her, our kids are somewhere back there. I don't know where. They're almost 11 years old now, for those who are wondering, which is hard to believe, I'm sure. Many of you remember the first day we brought them into this church as brand new babies, so time really does fly. 6 years ago, after completing my philosophy degree at the University of Lethbridge, our family packed up and moved to Vancouver so that I could attend Regent College, which is a theological grad school on the campus of UBC. We spent 3 very enjoyable years in Vancouver. I loved the opportunity to study at a world-class school. Naomi loved the big city life of Vancouver. And our kids took their first steps in the school system of a wonderfully diverse city. I think there were 6 different ethnicities in their first kindergarten class, which was a real gift for them and for us. So we spent 3 years at Regent in Vancouver, and I got my degree, and then we had a decision to make. What next? Well, we applied for a number of positions back here in Alberta, but nothing really worked out. We applied for a few in BC. Nothing really worked out there either. Except for one position that was always there, that kept coming back to us, was in Nanaimo on Vancouver Island. We didn't really want to go further west. We were hoping to maybe move a bit closer to home, but God opened doors and spoke to us, and we ended up taking a position in Nanaimo, which is on Vancouver Island, as an associate pastor at a Mennonite Brethren church there. We spent 3 very good years there, learning and growing as a family, and for me professionally as a pastor. 3 very good years. We loved the West Coast, our time in Vancouver and in Nanaimo. It was in many ways a hard place to leave, but this past summer of 2011, we accepted a call to come back to Southern Alberta to take the position of pastor at Lethbridge Mennonite Church. We were excited about the opportunity to move back home, and it's been a really good time of getting reacquainted with family and friends and being welcomed by a very wonderful and warm church community in Lethbridge. So I bring you greetings on behalf of Lethbridge Mennonite Church, and that's a really quick trip through the last 6 years of our family's life. God has led us to good places, God has been at work in our story as a family. And as we have sought to obey his call and to love God and love our neighbors wherever he has placed us. And I assume the same is true for you. I assume that in the past 6 years, you have been seeking also to live faithfully where God has placed you, in this place, to love others, to love your neighbors, to love God, whether as individuals or as families or as a church community. One of the themes that I want to explore this morning, the main theme actually, is the nature of the story that we are all a part of, whether we are in BC or Coaldale or anywhere in between or anywhere else in the world. What is the nature of this big story that we are all a part of as Christians, as followers of Jesus? One thing I have discovered in my 3+ decades on this earth is that it is very easy, very, very easy, over the course of everyday life, for our faith, for our view of God, for our view of a story that we are a part of, to shrink, to get smaller. Perhaps you have noticed the same thing. When I decided to go to university, I wanted to study philosophy and theology. I was asking very big questions. Questions about the nature of God, the nature of human freedom, the problem of evil, the nature of morality, etc., etc. And I've always been drawn to these huge questions about life ever since I was a little boy. I wanted a faith that could respond to the tough questions, a faith that was big enough to incorporate all of reality, a story within which to locate everything that I could see in my own experience and in the world around me. I wanted a big faith, and I wanted to learn how to ask good questions. And it was good for me to do this. It was good to ask these questions. It was good to study, to challenge my assumptions, to work through doubts and issues in the context of others who were doing the same thing. But as stimulating as these big questions were, as stimulating as these big pursuits were, as liberating as I experienced this big faith to be, I have discovered that it is incredibly easy for this big faith to shrink. And shrink down to the size of, well, me. When life starts to get a bit demanding, or a bit mundane, or routine, or frustrating, the big story of God, the big story of God's work in the world, the big world, gets reduced to what God is or is not doing for me. It's easy, it's far too easy, for me to begin to interpret the life of faith through the very, very narrow lens of my struggles, my insecurities, my needs, my requests and doubts, my fears, my frustrations, my hopes and desires, my. To the point where I forget that God has people and concerns and projects in this world that go beyond me. Imagine that. Rather than exhibiting a big faith in a big God who's in the process of reclaiming and redeeming all of creation, my faith can come to look much more like a personal self-help strategy whose sole intent is to make my life easier or more comfortable. Does this sound familiar to anyone? Or is this only me? Nothing, eh? Okay. Well, maybe it is just me. But anyways, it is easy, I think, for our faith to shrink down to a size of ourselves. The good news is that if we do our best to keep our eyes and ears open and our hearts open, God, I have found God to be remarkably persistent in expanding the walls of my faith. Remarkably inventive. Remarkably creative. I have found that if I am paying attention, I will discover that God is always eager to show me more of what he is up to in the world beyond my brain and my heart. Sometimes this happens gradually. Sometimes it happens more suddenly when I'm wrenched out of my routine life. For me, it was the latter. Some of you know that I recently returned from an MCC Alberta pastor's learning tour in Colombia, in South America. We spent 10 days in that beautiful country visiting churches and other MCC projects and partners down there, learning about the nation of Colombia and how MCC is at work in this place. Now, I didn't know much about Colombia before I went on this tour. I knew that it had a troubled past and it had lots of political turmoil and violence. I knew that there was more poverty there than there was in Canada. I knew that they spoke Spanish there. Doesn't that maybe make me remarkably culturally adept? I knew that a Colombian soccer player had once been murdered for scoring a goal into his own net at the World Cup. Really, I'm not joking. But beyond that, I didn't know much about this nation. I didn't know much about the people or the country of Colombia. Now, I learned many things about Colombia when I was there. But I think I can also say that God used this time and this place and these people to once again push against the borders of my faith, to push it out, to show me that faith is about more than just what's going on in my life, that it's about what God is doing in a world that is very big and very complicated and very troubled. So this morning I want to reflect on this idea of a bigger faith through the lens of a few stories from my time in Colombia. And I want to also reflect upon them through a very well-known passage of Scripture, Psalm 23. Now, many of you know this passage very well, and so you could probably recite it by memory. I probably could too, but I won't try because I might embarrass myself. So I'm going to read it from the English Standard Version. I still prefer this version to the NIV because it's more familiar to me. I suspect it's more familiar to many of you. So here's Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely, goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. A beautiful psalm, a beautiful hope. But maybe on one level you're thinking, it's a bit of an odd choice for a text, given what I've been talking about. First of all, isn't it a funeral text? Isn't this mostly where we hear this text read at funerals? And given all this talk about how we tend to constrict or shrink our view of faith into individualistic terms, there's a lot of individualistic language in that psalm, isn't there? The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He leads me on paths of righteousness, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. It's a personal prayer. How is it going to help us to locate ourselves within this bigger story, this bigger faith? Well, maybe a few stories from Colombia will help us. We spend our first few days in Colombia getting acclimatized, learning about the place, sitting in workshops. On the third day, our group piled into a van and headed to a region just south of Bogota to see some of the MCC projects down there. The further south we drove from the city, the more the scenery changed. Instead of the hustle and bustle of a modern city of almost 9 million people, we saw a sprawling hillside of patched together shacks of tin and wood surrounded by mud and dogs and garbage. We had entered a group of communities referred to as Kazuka, a community that is comprised entirely of displaced farmers, small farmers, who have been evicted from their land either by one of the many armed groups in the area or by big multinational corporations who are paying them to do so, or by their own government who want their land, whether this is for mineral excavation or for palm oil production or whatever. These farmers are called campesinos, and they flood into the cities of Colombia because they have nowhere else to go. All they know how to do is farm small pieces of land, and they are looking for work and for somewhere to stay. 5 million people in the nation of Colombia are internally displaced people, I discovered. 5 million out of about 45 million, which is astonishing. It's the highest number in the world by quite a large margin. So this place called Kazuka is filled with displaced people, with nothing to do, with no options, living in cardboard and tin. It is a bleak and dreary place, It's full of poverty, full of crime, full of neglect. It is a place that some spend only a few months in before finding something else, but some spend years, decades, lifetimes in a place like this. There is a valley that separates two of the main communities of Kazuka, and at the bottom of this valley is a dirty old lake referred to as the Laguna Negra. Does anybody know Spanish? Anybody know what that means? The Black Lake. Now, the image that I hope that you see on the wall, yes, thank you, Spencer, is of this lake in this valley. This is where all the runoff goes when the rains fall. This is where all the garbage and the debris and the animal feces ends up. And rumor has it, even a few dead bodies of people who were dispatched because they were causing trouble or stirring up unrest. It is a dark, dark place. Psalm 23, verse 4, the psalm we just read refers to the valley of the shadow of death. I thought of Psalm 23, verse 4 when I walked through this valley. If ever there was a valley of the shadow of death, I thought, this is it. How does Psalm 23 sound in a place like this? How do they hear it there? There are three statements in this psalm that are called imperative statements. Three I wills or I shalls. And I want to read these three statements through the lens of this valley, this place. The first one comes in verse 1. I shall not want, David says. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. But how can we not want? If not for ourselves, then for people who live here. How can we not want on behalf of these people? How can we be people of contentment and gratitude in a world where such extraordinary injustice and inequality exists? How can we be people of contentment and gratitude when we know that so often it is our excess as wealthy Western Christians, or Westerners in general, our lack of contentment with all of our stuff, our overconsumption, that leads to problems like we see here? How can we be people who do not want when we know that there are such alarming realities out there in our world? When instead of green pastures and still waters, we see mud and gravel and the Laguna Negra. I shall not want, David says, but we do want. All of us want. We want better things for ourselves, for the people of our world, for our children, for our communities, for our families, for our church. We want many things. We want to see people set free from addictions. We want to see broken relationships healed. We want to see people we care about come to faith. We want to see those who are used to getting the short end of the stick experience blessing. We want many things, don't we? And at our best, we want good things. We want to see God's kingdom come, on earth as it is in heaven. In a fallen and broken world, it is hard not to want. But the psalmist says, I shall not want. Is our faith big enough to acknowledge that even though our world is full of need, full of injustice, full of inequality, full of suffering and pain, that we are to embrace our role as agents of transformation and reconciliation in this context? Is our faith big enough to hold those two things together? Can we look at the world with all of its pain, with all of its need, and still claim a contentment that transcends circumstances, and at the same time recognizes our obligation to bring about change? Can our faith be that big? The second statement in verse 4. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. But we do fear evil, don't we? Because evil is a fearful thing. This was evident as we walk through this valley that you see behind me on the screen. Our guides explained to us that this long path that wound through these two communities and up the other side was not often traveled at night due to fears of gang violence and theft. In fact, only minutes before our arrival there, there had been a funeral procession of a teenager who had been murdered just that week in some kind of a conflict with gang violence. We had to instruct our bus driver to pick us up at a different location because our presence, he said, had been noted and that we probably weren't safe to go back through this valley. There'd be people waiting for us there. "I will fear no evil, for you are with me," says David. But it's not easy, is it? It's not easy to not be afraid in a world where such evil exists. Here in Coaldale or southern Alberta, we don't have to contend with this kind of evil. But evil is not restricted to South America or Colombia. What are we tempted to fear here in Coaldale? What are we afraid of? What evils lurk for us? Are we afraid of an undignified death? A long and drawn-out illness? Are we afraid that our kids will be bullied at school? Do we fear the evil of mental illness and depression? I'm sure you could add to my list. Is our faith big enough to see clearly that even though there is profound evil in God's good world, personal, societal, whatever, that we can continue to follow and trust God even when the valleys are dark, even when evil lurks? Is our faith big enough to trust that all of the evil that God has allowed into the big story of the world or into the little story of our family, our church, whatever? Is our faith big enough to trust that the evil that God allows can be healed, can be redeemed, can be restored, and incorporated into a future of hope and a future of peace? Is our faith that big? The last one, verse 6, "I shall dwell in the house of the Lord." This is the hope of everyone who trusts in God. But sometimes the house of the Lord seems like a long ways off in the horizon, doesn't it? For David and for ancient Israel, the house of the Lord was the place where God dwelt. It was a place where heaven and earth joined together. It was a place where two spheres of reality collided: the visible realm that you could see and smell and touch and hear and taste, and the invisible realm of God and his purposes for the world. The house of the Lord symbolized a place of security and safety, a place where fear and longing were no more. But in this place, other, more familiar houses dominate the landscape, houses of disrepair, houses of neglect and houses of violence and abuse, houses of hunger and lethargy, houses that are falling apart, patched together with tin and wood and plastic. "I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." Here in Coaldale, our houses do not look like the houses you see on this sprawling hillside. They are much safer, much more impressive. But they are still a long ways from the house of the Lord. We may have more creature comforts, we may have more secure houses, but they are at best temporary dwellings, imperfect refuges in a fallen world. Whether we are in Kazuka or in Coaldale, all of us long to be in the place where God is, where God dwells. We long for security that cannot be threatened, for anxiety to no longer be present. We long for peace and harmony that cannot be undone by a cruel word or a careless action. All of us long to dwell in the house of the Lord. Is our faith big enough to live in this in-between time with hope and trust, when the object of our longing is still a long ways away? Is our faith big enough and strong enough to pursue paths of righteousness for Christ's sake, even when the fulfillment of our hope seems a long ways off? Three statements I shall not want, I will not fear. I will dwell in the house of the Lord. Do those phrases work in a place like this? In a place like this? For me, this valley that you see behind you on the screen has come to represent a challenge to pray this psalm with both hope and commitment and obedience, as well as honesty. When I read this psalm through the lens of the people I met and the things that I saw and heard in Colombia, I am reminded that this psalm requires big faith for a big world. And I am reminded that it wasn't easy for David to pray this prayer either. I don't think evil was any less real in David's day than our own. David knew what it was to be harassed by enemies. David knew what it was to be plagued by temptation. David's prayer comes from a place of knowing that the world is broken, knowing that he is broken, and knowing that he needs a shepherd who is good to lead him home. And I think this is true for all of us. Near the end of the psalm, we read these words: "Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life." It is a beautiful hope. Is it true? Do goodness and mercy follow us all the days of our lives? One more story, and then I'll sit down. During the second half of our tour, we left the rainy and cool climate of Bogota, and we went out to the coast, where it was sweltering. It was unbelievably hot and humid, and most of us were starting to get ill, so it wasn't a place that has as fond memories for me as Bogota. But we were going to visit some smaller cities up there, and we were going to see some more people and hear some more stories about how MCC was at work with people who had been displaced. One of the cities we went to was called Sincelejo, which is a city of around 250,000 people, 90,000 of whom are displaced people. So that's a city the size of Lethbridge inside the city the size of Saskatoon that is displaced people. And you can imagine all the problems that come along with that, the crime, the poverty, everything. So in this city, one night we visited a church that was called Remanso de Paz, which means Refuge of Peace, which was a church comprised entirely of displaced people. Over supper that night and over a bumpy ride into the jungle the next day, we heard the story of this church, of this community. We heard about their former life as small farmers. We heard about the terror of the days of violence they had all suffered through, about being forced from their land. We heard about the difficulties that they and their children had had adjusting to city life, from going from almost medieval conditions in the country to a modern city, which, as you can imagine, was very difficult. We also heard stories of their faith. The pastor of this church told us a story about how the church came to be, where it was located. Initially, they had met in homes, but then they grew, and they needed somewhere more permanent to meet for worship and for classes and for workshops and etc. There weren't a lot of options in the city, but one site emerged. It was a garbage dump. Initially, the pastor was very reluctant to build a church on a garbage dump. She told us, "I fought against God. I said, a garbage dump is no place for the house of the Lord. But then God began to speak to me, to change me," she said. "He told me, why shouldn't the house of the Lord be built on a garbage dump? After all, I specialize in renovating things full of ugliness and making them into things of beauty. Look what I did with you." And so today, this church meets on a garbage dump. They built their church on a garbage dump. It's a beautiful little place. Very humble, but very beautiful. Alive, with singing, with prayer, with meals together. These people sit around tables on what used to be a garbage dump. They sing songs, they share meals, they discuss land reform and restitution laws. They tell stories of their former lives on the land. They speak of their longing to return. They teach people in their community and their children about Jesus as the path to peace, and they teach them of the importance of nonviolence in the context that is all too familiar with violence. They talk about how, even they don't always understand it, they believe that God has led them from their farms to the city for a reason, and that they're trusting God to lead them back. Earlier this morning, we sang Be Thou My Vision. It's one of my favorite songs. I don't know if somebody knew that when they picked it, but the last verse says, "Heart of my heart, whatever befalls, still be my vision, O ruler of all." I thought of these people when we sang that line. Whatever befalls, still be my vision, O ruler of all. These people are what their name says. They are a refuge of peace. They are a living testimony to the goodness and mercy of God in a difficult place. They are a witness to their community that there's an alternative to violence and despair that is so common in their city. Their very existence as a church in that place, on that garbage dump, is evidence that they have been followed by the goodness and mercy of God, of the Good Shepherd. This church is not built on a garbage dump, to the best of my knowledge. But we follow the same shepherd, the same good shepherd. This church does not face the same challenges and struggles as the people that I've been talking about this morning. But every church around the world faces its own challenges and its own struggles. All of our lives have garbage. All of us contribute to and are affected by the ugliness of our world, the brokenness of our world. All of us have ugliness inside of us. In a world where God's will is not yet done on earth as it is in heaven. And so my prayer for us this morning, for all of us, whether we are in Columbia or in Coaldale or anywhere in between, is that we would continue to walk and to live and to believe into this big faith, a big faith for a big world. A faith that sees the whole world as the object of God's love, the object of God's desire, the object of God's redemptive purposes. A faith that sees this whole world and it sees ourselves clearly and honestly and still chooses to hope, chooses to trust, chooses to follow. My prayer is that we would follow this good shepherd. This good shepherd who leads us through dark valleys, who walks through dark valleys for our sake, as we will celebrate in a moment here. Who, to quote Eugene Peterson's translation of this psalm, always chases after us with beauty and with love. May God help us to follow this good shepherd who is determined to create good things out of garbage dumps. May God help us to follow him all the days of our lives. Amen. Thank you.